It's 6 hours, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Vote counting underway following Myanmar, that is, first free election in a quarter of a century. Some observers believing the election could provide a win to Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party. VOA's Steve Herman reporting.
The question is not whether the NLD is able to be the largest vote getter among the 90 or more parties that are contesting in this parliamentary election. The question is whether they can capture two-thirds of the parliamentary seats to overcome this distinct advantage that the military and the government have, because a fifth of these seats are reserved for them. So they need this two-thirds majority to really get through parliament what they want, and more critically, be able to select who will be the next president of Myanmar.
VOA's Steve Herman. European tourists are leaving the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh by the thousands following the October 31st airline disaster that killed 224 people on board. Some 5,000 British citizens were departed by the end of Sunday. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the repatriation of his country's travelers from the Sinai resort and militants claiming affiliation with the Islamic State for that attack. France has requested a UN Security Council meeting today to discuss the deteriorating situation in Burundi. Saturday, the United States expressed grave concern over the political and security situation and the condemned killing of the son of a rights activist. Late Saturday, 9 people were executed by unknown gunmen in the capital, Bujumbura. Security forces launching a crackdown on a search for illegal weapons. A weapons ban ended at midnight on Saturday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington for meetings today with President Obama. Russell Stone, the former director of American University's Center for Israel Studies, speaks with VOA about today's meeting and the personal relationship between the two leaders.
Their personal relationship has always been a testy one, at best mistrust and at worst suspicion of the motives of each other. And it will be interesting to see if they can succeed in putting forth a public persona of at least cordiality. As for what will come out of it, most commentators claim that it's more just a mending of fences to try to reaffirm the agreements between the United States and Israel for supply of defensive weapons systems, and if possible, to extend the time horizon for that agreement, as well as to give additional recent technology to Israel, particularly stealth technology in fighter aircraft.
Prime Minister Netanyahu angered President Obama by coming to Washington in March this year without his invitation or approval in an attempt to get the U.S. Congress to reject the Iran nuclear deal. Also, the Obama administration has made no secret of its frustration about Israel stalling on the two-nations solution. Pope Francis says the leaking of sensitive Vatican documents is a crime and a deplorable act that will not stop him from moving forward with church reforms. Two people suspected of leaking the documents were arrested last week. Information about the leaked documents was used for two books detailing mismanagement and corruption at the Vatican. Facing a massive migrant crisis and a struggling economy, Croatian voters went to the polls Sunday to elect a new parliament. Unofficial vote tallies show the conservative opposition Croatian Democratic Union winning about 60 seats in Sunday's parliamentary polling, with the ruling Social Democrats carrying 53. With 50% of the ballots tallied, a new party called Most was running third with a projected 19 seats in the 151-member legislature. The party appeared poised to play a crucial role in upcoming talks to form a new government. World Bank is warning that global warming will push 100 million more people into poverty across the globe in the next 15 years in the absence of further action by developed nations to curb rising temperatures. In a report released Sunday, the bank called for rapid, inclusive, and climate-smart development, together with emission reductions aimed at protecting the world's most vulnerable inhabitants. The report comes ahead of a global summit on climate change that opens November 30th in Paris.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, filling in for James Batty, who will be back tomorrow. Today is Monday, November 9, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Campaigning for Ugandan presidential election begins today.
As the campaign begins, we already harmonized the campaign program for the 8 candidates in the race, and we signed a memorandum of understanding with all those 8 candidates or their official agents, those who are not able to make it.
Jotam Taremwa, spokesman for the Uganda Electoral Commission, tells us more. And dry season brings increased fear of terrorism in northern Cameroon.
With the Nigerian border more than 150 kilometers away, this part of the far north is not considered risky territory. Yet, soldiers have raised checkpoints on the highway, while the population has created self-defense groups to keep watch.
Journalist Eugene Mfongwa tells us more. Plus, a recent conference in Nairobi discusses the radicalization of youth in East Africa, and a successful project in Kenya helps educate the nomadic Samburu pastoralist. Those stories, plus Makaume Sports and our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Official campaign for Uganda's presidential election begins today as candidates, including incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, former Prime Minister Patrick Amama Mbabazi, and main opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye, complete establishing their campaign teams. The presidential campaign will end on February 16 next year, according to the Electoral Commission. Jotam Taremwa, spokesman for the Electoral Commission, told me that the electoral body signed a memorandum of understanding with the political parties to stick to the stipulations in the agreement.
The campaign for presidential election kick off the 9th of November 2016, and they will be ending on the 16th of February 2016. As the campaigns begin, we already harmonized the campaign program for the 8 candidates in the race, and we signed a memorandum of understanding with all those 8 candidates or their official agents, those who are not able to make it. Now, we expect everybody to keep to the harmonized and approved campaign program by the Electoral Commission. Should there be any change on the part of candidate A in the schedule, that change must be communicated to the Electoral Commission for the candidate himself or herself effective. Secondly, these campaigns will be ending at 6 p.m. Ugandan time every day, including the current president, who is also in the race. So we expect that legal requirement to be observed and complied with. Secondly, I want to request that as the candidates go about their campaign, they conduct peaceful and harmonious campaign. We don't want candidates to divide our people along tribal or religious lines.
You spoke about the issue of these presidential candidates avoiding ethnic sentiment or religious sentiment to undermine the bond that exists between Ugandans. How do you enforce this, and what punishment or consequences are there for any candidate who engages in such act that could create violence and instability?
Well, the enforcement is on the part of the police force. We are working closely with the Uganda police force in monitoring the campaign programs of the candidates. And if anybody engages in those, there are sanctions within the law that can be applied. So for now, I can only say that we wish them to stick to the law, and if they violate the law will be pulled out, and those sanctions that
he had
spelled out.
Jotam Taremwa is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Uganda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. It is dry season in the far north of Cameroon, and that means the arrival of 30-plus degree heat and swarms of giant black flies. On the list of seasonal worries this year, residents in the region are adding a possible spike in Boko Haram attacks. Eugene Mfongwa reports from Maroua.
Swaths of northern Cameroon are covered by only scanty bushes all year round. In the dry season, nearly all the vegetation and rivers simply disappear, leaving a flat sandy terrain. As visitors know, you can point a vehicle or motorcycle in any direction and start racing. For years, this was the beauty of the region. Residents mapped shorter routes to their destination, and tourists easily reached wild game. But as a Lamido or local chief, Aliou Mamadou, says, things have changed dramatically in the past 3 years.
Le passage, surtout aujourd'hui avec l'arrêt des pluies.
The departure of the rains, he says, means the terrain is practicable almost everywhere outlaws like Boko Haram choose to go.
Les malfaiteurs, comme les Boko Haram peuvent aller.
Amadou's kingdom is a roadside collection of villages that sit on the Chadian border, southeast of the regional capital Marwa. Most of the people there are sorghum farmers, headsmen, and micro-business owners who are mandated by tradition to welcome strangers. With the Nigerian border more than 150 kilometers away, this part of the far north is not considered risky territory. Yet, soldiers have raised checkpoints on the highway, while the population has created self-defense groups to keep watch.
Il est préoccupant, ça, je le vous assure. Nous ne dormons pas.
Amadou says the security situation is so worrying that inhabitants of his village are not sleeping.
Toute présence suspecte.
When the neighbor's house is burning, he says, you start pouring water on yours.
Quand la maison brûle, commencez à mouiller la maison, votre la case d'à côté, nous aussi.
The main fear that runs deep across the region is that suicide bombers can still sneak into crowded places and detonate bombs. In spite of high military presence, Boko Haram has successfully carried out more than a dozen deadly attacks this year. Two of them killed at least 34 people in Marwa, the main city once considered the safest place in the far north. With rivers drying up and bushes disappearing during the dry season, a driver called Yauba says terrorists can roam deeper hinterlands. Yauba says someone can leave Marwa and go as far as Kusiri without using any of the main roads. When it is wet and rivers are flowing, they will be forced to use bridges. But he says that is not the case in the dry season. In the meantime, the government, private organizations, and individuals are stepping up security. Banks, schools, and even restaurants have cordoned their facilities with white and red tape and hired security guards to filter visitors. Last month, the United Nations started building a second concrete fence around its multi-agency compound in Marwa. The Rapid Response Battalion, the military unit at the forefront of the fight against Boko Haram, now has a deep trench running around its command base in Salak. And anyone traveling by air must go through a military checkpoint outside the Marwa International Airport. Eugene Fongwa, reporting for VOA Africa in Marwa, Cameroon.
Religious excuses for incidents of violence have been on the rise in Africa. At a meeting in Nairobi recently, experts examined ways of challenging the rising levels of radicalization among the youth. From the Kenyan capital, reporter Ruben Chiama reports.
Participants from Nigeria, Cameroon and Kenya explored the local contexts of religious violence and examined the potential responses of African governments and security agencies. Speakers compared violent groups in northeast Nigeria, north Cameroon and the coastal and northeast region of Kenya and cited various common factors that explore the problem. Miss Fatma Chari Mohammed, a security expert from Nigeria, was among the key speakers at the forum.
It's about addressing the fundamental issues. The fundamental issues being the socioeconomic issues, the governance issues, corruption, weak states.
Mohammed, a senior expert with a leading West African conflict and security consulting firm based in Nigeria, is now focusing her attention on the crisis in northern Nigeria.
There seems to be a lot of misconception and a lot of misunderstanding between the two major religions in this country. Where Nigeria is concerned, we've kind of depassed that stage to a certain extent because people now understand that terrorism is not necessarily about religious ideology. It's more about political ideology and looking for alternatives, alternatives for livelihoods.
Among those alternatives for livelihoods, said the forum participants, are solutions to youth unemployment and lack of participation in local and national politics. Father Wilbert Lago, assistant bishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Mombasa, said religious leaders in collaboration with state organs and local communities were involved in finding solutions to the problem. He said one way was trying to ensure that the voices of the youth were heard. While this is not new for countries like Nigeria, Cameroon and to some extent Kenya, it is a relatively novel phenomenon in the continent. Sheikh Ibrahim Lithome, a Kenyan Islamic scholar, warned against widespread misuse of religious texts which can be used by individuals as an excuse to commit violence.
Hakuna kundi moja ama mshikadao mmoja ambao.
He says everyone, including government, religious leaders, women groups, the society at large, as well as the media, should be involved in the debate. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington. Today is Monday, November 9th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Ahead on our program, Mark Omer Sports and our listener of the day. In Africa, policymakers, NGOs, and grassroots activists agree that education is key if the continent is to compete effectively amid globalization. Until recently, the Samburu, a traditional pastoralist people in remote northeastern Kenya, had little access to the education needed to cope with the encroaching modern world. One U.S.-based nonprofit group is working with tribal elders to build and maintain 21st-century schools while keeping crucial aspects of the Samburu's ancient desert culture alive and well. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The Samburu are a semi-nomadic people who depend on their ancient skills and wits to survive in the desert with their cattle, goats, and camels. Their warriors carry spears, and their women are adorned with elaborate, brilliantly colored beads that denote their status within the tribe. Thorn Tree Project founder Jane Newman says the Samburu live far away from modern Africa.
They're very isolated. They're cut off from the rest of the world. There's no roads, no telephones, no prenatal care, no running water, nothing.
Newman first met the Samburu in 1999 when her vehicle broke down on a backcountry adventure.
Before I met them, all the elders had realized that the modern world was encroaching, and they realized they were not at all prepared for it. They couldn't speak English or Kiswahili. They couldn't communicate with the outside world. They didn't know what resources were available that they could ask for or how to ask for them. And also they were afraid of being taken advantage of. So they asked us, me, at the time, if I could help them get more of their kids to go to school.
Newman returned about 2 years later, ready to help.
At that time, in the two pre-primary schools, they had 130 students, and maybe about a quarter of them graduated. But their main problem, and the main thing that we deal with, is the fact that they're nomadic. So these three schools that are in their area are anywhere from 10 to 100 kilometers away from the family. So if they're migrating or moving, their children have to go to boarding school. So that was clearly a problem because they didn't have any real boarding facilities.
And the other issue was that few of them had been to school and most didn't know what school was. So the Thorn Tree Project started with two preschools.
And they've been hugely successful. We actually have 15 of them now. They're run by the community. They make all the decisions. A warrior with at least 2 years' experience is the teacher or a mother. So they usually have like a spear in one hand and a piece of chalk in the other. And there's no building, it's just mobile. So they find the largest shady thorn tree around, prop a blackboard up against a tree trunk, and then that's the school.
Today, nearly 1,400 Samburu attend preschool or primary school. Over 150 young people have received Thorn Tree scholarships for secondary school, which is the normal gateway in Kenya to higher education at a trade school or university, which many have also now attended. The Thorn Tree Project owes much of its success to the personal connections it fosters. Its administration is 100% volunteer, so all contributions go to schools, infrastructure, and scholarships, not bureaucracy. Both Jane Newman and Clota say that as the Thorn Tree Project continues to grow, its emphasis will broaden as well. Future plans include greater opportunities for girls and women to become leaders within the Samburu tribe and in Kenya overall. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Hundreds of delegates from across Africa and around the world recently met in Cape Town, South Africa, to discuss youth unemployment and potential opportunities for them in agriculture. The summit, dubbed Young Africa Works, was hosted by the MasterCard Foundation. It attracted senior government officials, business executives, representatives from the private sector and the civil society, along with international donors, as well as youth delegates. From Cape Town, South Africa, VOA's Ruben Chiama reports.
The summit focused on best practices and effective approaches for preparing young people for employment and entrepreneurship opportunities in agriculture. It also encouraged young participants to explore the challenges they face in securing meaningful economic opportunities. Speaking to the Voice of America at the close of the summit, Rita Roy, President and Chief Executive Officer of the MasterCard Foundation, said the conference helped to stimulate unique, fresh thinking around ways in which young people can make the transition into employment, especially into agricultural sector.
We saw some very demonstrable examples of how young people are already taking action. We heard from a young entrepreneur who began at the Africa Rabbit Center when she was 14 years old. And we learned that each female rabbit can generate revenue of $1,000 a year.
A recent study conducted over the past 6 months revealed that some 600 million people in Africa are under the age of 25, and 72% of its youth live on less than $2 a day. The findings highlight the extraordinary length that young people go to as they try to find work. Namonje says the lack of access to credit facilities among the youth is a major deterrent.
Most youths don't have capital. You go to a bank, they need collateral. You're only 18 or 20, and you haven't accumulated any assets to use to go and borrow funds and all that.
Regarding the foundation's work in Africa, Roy said the Toronto-based organization is working in 28 countries across the continent, where it has committed $1.6 billion. She says its programs are concentrated in three areas.
One is to expand access to financial services for people who are living in poverty. Second is to expand access to education, especially the secondary level and at the higher education level. And third is to bring what we know from financial services and education to really focus on enabling young people who never had the chance to go to school to be able to transition from unemployment or maybe hazardous work to decent work so they can have sustainable livelihoods.
She said the first agricultural sector is critical to the transformation of the continent, both economically and socially. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sport. Let's join Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Second half goals scored by Victor Osimhen and Afonso Bangboy lifted defending champions Nigeria Golden Eaglets to a 2-0 triumph over Mali in the finals at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Viña del Mar in Chile on Sunday. Osimhen also sets a record of 10 goals scored during the tournament. Earlier on, Belgium edged Mexico 3-2 in the bronze medal playoff. Meanwhile, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe are the Orange African Champions League title holders. TP Mazembe beat their Algerian visitors USM Algiers 2-0 in the return leg of their final in Lubumbashi on Sunday. TP Mazembe prevailed on a 4-1 aggregate. This is TP Mazembe's fifth title after clinching the coveted cup in 1967, 1968, 2009 and 2010. Elsewhere, hosts Ghana outclassed Ethiopia 4-0 in Kumasi as visitors Nigeria pipped South Africa 1-0 in Johannesburg in the return leg of the Africa qualifiers for the FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup. Ghana prevailed on a 6-2 aggregate while Nigeria are 3-1 ahead. Ghana and Nigeria qualify for the 2016 FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup due in Papua New Guinea. In disability sports, hosts Algeria has qualified to represent Africa in the men's and women's wheelchair basketball competition at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Paralympic Games. In the men's contest, Algeria beat Morocco 74-63 in the final at the Africa Wheelchair wheelchair basketball championships in Algiers on Saturday. South Africa prevailed over Egypt 77-65 in the bronze medal playoff. In the women's contest, Algeria beat South Africa 60-47 in the final, while Nigeria overpowered Morocco 56-6 to clinch the bronze medal. Finally, in athletics, Kenyan Paul Loyangata clocked 2 hours, 7 minutes and 14 seconds to set a course record at the Shanghai International Marathon in China on Sunday. South African defending champion Stephen Mokoka was runner-up in a personal best of 2 hours, 7 minutes and 40 seconds. Ethiopian Tola Shura Kitata was third. Meanwhile, Kenyan Rael Kiara won the women's race in 2 hours, 26 minutes and 23 seconds. She was followed across the finish line by Ethiopians Letrabra Haile and Rahman Tusa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Peter, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Yes, our listener mail for this Monday, November 9th.
Attention, please. In addition to the proposed 10,000 policemen to be recruited in Nigeria, Mr. President Buhari should also please approve a payroll for the vigilantes that have been on voluntary services for the past 11 years without salaries. I have been John Shear in Opaneku, God's Advocate, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comments. Please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Before we leave you, let's take a look at more news of interest to Africa. Gunmen stormed into a bar in Burundi's capital Bujumbura late Saturday, killing at least 9 people. Witnesses say the attackers ordered people sitting outside to come inside the building, then opened fire, killing 7 instantly. 2 died later from their wounds. Witnesses told the French news agency the gunmen wore police uniforms. U.S. President Barack Obama says he plans to remove Burundi from a U.S. trade preference program because of the worsening crackdown on the political opposition there. After Nkurunziza's return to office, the decision by Nkurunziza to run for a third term sparked anger from many Burundians who said he was violating the constitution and the Arusha Accord that ended the country's 13-year civil war. Obama said the violence in Burundi worsened significantly during Nkurunziza's election campaign. Clashes between police and protesters and fear of unrest has prompted some 200,000 Burundians to flee the country, with most going to Tanzania or Rwanda. Human Rights Watch says Burundi seems to be descending into uncontrolled violence. A frightening lawlessness is taking hold, which some authorities appear to be taking advantage to justify brutal repression. Politically motivated killings are more frequent by the day, with hardly any of the killers arrested or prosecuted. That's it for this Monday, November 9 edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Ricky Shryock, managing editor Bill Eagle, I'm Peter Clote in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next on Let's Talk, pet peeves. Do you have one? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing pet peeves. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is facing his toughest challenge yet. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they explore the possibility of major opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Dr. Kizza Besigye, joining forces in next year's Ugandan poll. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
voaafrica.com.
Visit voaafrica.com and subscribe to our podcast service.